Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, 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 and welcome to the podcast. I'm here once more.
Pod.
With the uncontrollable Peter Hart, and I am Gary Bain. What are we doing today, Pete?
We're doing Zeppelin raids on Britain. 1914-16.
Now, this is one episode where you'll be able to use sausage.
Yes, legitimately.
Quite a lot, yeah.
Yeah. So let's. What's the background to this? Well, aerial warfare. When was the first aeroplane flight? 1904 or something, wasn't it? By 1911, they'd showed the peaceful potential by dropping the Italians dropped a few bombs in the Turco-Italian War in Libya. How much of impact do you reckon, Gary? Do you think they blasted the Turkish army from the face of the earth?
No, it would have had very limited impact, but it was more of a warning to the British, particularly, that in one sense, they were no longer invulnerable on their island, defending by the might of the senior service, the Royal Navy.
No longer an island.
God bless them and all who sailed in them.
Yeah, yeah. So war. War, Gary. War. When does that come?
Well, that comes in 1914, and the early plans to bomb Britain that the Germans had were dependent on taking Calais.
Why? Why?
Well, that's because their aircraft, in fact anybody's aircraft at the time, didn't have the range for raids over Britain.
They couldn't have got there and back.
No, so they therefore gave a high priority to develop bombing aircraft with a longer range.
What were they called?
I thought you might ask me. They were called the Großkampfflugzeug, or G-plane. I think we'll call them G-plane.
I'm going to call them Gothas.
All right, well, that was the best known of them, wasn't it? The Gotha G4.
Now, does this sort of take a couple of months to develop
this
airplane? No,
that's not going to appear until 1917. So the Germans are quite frustrated in their plan to attack Britain from the air with aeroplanes.
Ah, but they've got something else. What else have they got?
Well, they turned to their fleet of airships, the Zeppelins.
Sausages.
They had both the range and capacity for a reasonable bomb load. And there'd been Zeppelin flights since about 1900, so a well-tested method of flight.
Yeah, they were, yeah. Now, what sort of preparations does no longer an island Britain make?
Well, the War Office and the Admiralty, they're fully aware of the need to create.
So they worked in harmony, did they?
Well, we'll come on to that. to maintain an aerial defence of Britain. Unfortunately, they couldn't agree on how this should be done.
That's not like the Army and the Admiralty.
No. Well, since the first days of military aviation, the Army had jealously guarded its claim to complete responsibility for defending the nation's skies, although I'm not quite sure why.
Well, especially as when war came, all its strength, nearly all its personnel and all its airplanes, well, guess where, Rock? Can you guess where? Can you guess where?
Clacton.
No. Not Clacton-on-Sea.
France, then.
France and Belgium, the Western Front. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So this is there's a simile that's close to my head.
Do you mean the one that suggests that the army found itself in the position of a bald man arguing over a comb?
That one. I very rarely argue over combs or hairbrushes
or anything to do with barbers.
No. Barbers, what are they?
Now, fortunately, the Royal Navy Air Service, in the time-honoured fashion of the Royal Navy, had to some extent simply ignored the Royal Flying Corps.
And you're going to speak up for them, aren't you? Because you are going to be Winston Churchill, first Lord of the Admiralty.
The War Office claimed, on behalf of the Flying Corps, complete and sole responsibility for the aero defence of Great Britain. But, owing to the difficulties of getting money, they were unable to make any provision for this responsibility. Every aircraft they had being earmarked for the expeditionary force. Seeing this, and finding myself able to procure funds by various shifts and devices, I began in 1912 and 1913 to form, under the Royal Naval Air Service, flights of airplanes, as well as seaplanes, for the aerial protection of our naval harbours, oil tanks, and vulnerable points, and also for the general strengthening of our exiguous and inadequate aviation.
Cool, yummy.
I did his accent when he was a bit younger.
Before the alcohol had got to him.
Yes. Yes, before the alcohol.
Yes, I was like, yeah, he had that accent because he had a cleft palate. He didn't have a cleft palate when he was young.
Now, on the 3rd of September 1914, so very early in the war, an agreement was reached whereby the War Office relinquished their responsibility for the aerial defence of the realm to the Admiralty.
So they would just cooperate with anti-aircraft fire.
The army, you mean, yeah.
Yeah, where possible. And make they'd also make available any pilots and airplanes that were waiting transfer to the Western Front. In other words, as they were there, they might as well use them. And that was...
And despite this, the resources allocated to air defence, they're still woeful.
Woeful.
And a point illustrated by the treatment meted out to the first pilot assigned to the Royal Naval Air Service flight at Hendon, which was intended to defend London. And you're going to be Flight Sub-Lieutenant Eric Bowman of the Hendon Flight, London Air Defence, Royal Naval Air Service.
I met the CO and he said, "Can you fly a Cowdron?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, you've got to. It's the only one we've got. Do you know the way to Hendon?" I said, "No." "Well, at dawn tomorrow, you will fly in a Cowdron to Hendon." I went straight to the Admiralty after I landed, and the fellow in charge of airplanes there said, "Now, you are the air defence of London, the only one." I said, "But I've got no guns or observer or anything. What sort of protection can I give against the Germans?" He said, "I'll leave that to you." So I hoped the Zeppelins wouldn't come over. So, in other words, it's just a very... There is no air defence at this stage, is there?
No. Now, landing grounds that were later to develop into full-blown stations, they were prepared with emergency landing grounds in the major London parts.
So you've got the outer stations and then emergency landing grounds. Yeah, but no real airplanes or proper system. Yeah. Now, what else are they doing?
Well, in addition to the lack of viable aeroplanes, I replaced the word paucity there, see, just to show you I knew what it meant. The provision, disposition and manning of high-angle anti-aircraft guns. Now, that's also proving to be a difficult problem.
It is. So, which bit of London do you think they protected? Tottenham?
East
End?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, they clearly, it was the heart of London between Buckingham Palace
that's
and Charing Cross.
Buckingham Palace.
Yeah, it encompasses the Admiralty, the War Office and the Houses of Parliament. And they were to be defended by a small link system of searchlights and guns, all controlled from a central gun position at Admiralty Arch.
I bet that's not really, you know, going to be much good. The Royal Navy is at this time unable to supply enough men to man the installations, although they do have enough men to create the Royal Naval Division. Never mind. It was decided to return to the Army the responsibility for all anti-aircraft gun defences outside of London. So they'll run that little patch in London defending the royal family and politicians and everywhere else, distributed in penny packets everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't...
Any
there
real
wasn't
impact
a lot of,
you think they'd have, those penny packets?
I mean, there's not... There's very few suitable guns available, aren't there?
So. Yeah, there are. Oh, high angle, yeah. Yeah.
Well, so they put them in the obvious places.
Where? What's an obvious place?
Well, obvious military targets include things such as the dockyards, for example, and key munitions factories dotted around the rest of the country.
They'd go bang, wouldn't they, munitions factories?
Yeah, they would. Now, from the start, attempts were made to disguise the capital against detection from the air. So they put like a funny face on it. but they were tempted by the fact that London's size meant that it could never be totally concealed. And I'm going to be Winifred Tower,
so a civilian. So you're going to tell us about the blackout. Is it an early blackout she's going to tell us about?
Yeah, and we're going to have a number of civilians today, aren't we? So this is the view from Winifred Tower.
Okay.
That sounds like I'm up a tower.
Yeah. Or Toa.
When I say the view from Winifred Tower...
Or Toa.
Or Toa.
As you used to say in those far-off South Notts-Sars days.
Winifred Tower. Lighting regulations were very strict in London, and the streets were very dark at night. In Prince's Gate, every other lamp was lighted, and in many places, only every third or fourth. All illuminated shop signs were forbidden. Also, bright headlights on motorcars, etc. Blinds had to be pulled down as soon as the lights were lit and all skylights shaded, and the penalties for breaking the rules were pretty severe. People began to make preparations for Zeppelin raids. One big wine dealer was reported to have let several of his cellars, and people we knew had furnished theirs and slept with big coats and handbags for valuables by the bedside. Most people had water or buckets of sand or fire extinguishers on every landing. We rather laughed at this at first, but by degrees, everyone came round to taking certain precautions.
Now, this is one of those classic things. You're waiting for something to happen. You're waiting for something to happen. You're making preparations. And what happened in 1914 with the Zeppelin raid?
Nothing.
It didn't come, did it?
Didn't come. But the Germans were devoting considerable resources to building up their Zeppelin force. And by 1915, they were ready to begin bombing.
Right. So what is the overall... I mean, bombing of a city, are there any restrictions imposed by anybody?
Yeah, I mean, they had the backing of Kaiser Wilhelm II, but he did ask that only civilian areas and the royal palaces should be avoided. The commencement of a policy of regular bombing raids brought the crude essence of war a good deal closer than ever before to the British civilian population.
Yeah, because the Napoleonic Wars, things like that, you just miss. You don't know they're going on hardly if you read fiction of the time sometimes, which I do often in my spare moments, Carol. Rarely found without a Jane Austen by my side.
I'm speechless. Anyway, the first Zeppelin raid was carried out by the naval Zeppelins.
What number?
L3, L4 and L6.
Where was L5?
On the 19th of January 1915. Although L6 had to turn back with engine trouble, L3 and L4 reached the Norfolk coast and dropped their bombs in an apparently indiscriminate fashion on the towns of Yarmouth and King's Lynn, neither of which in any way defended against aerial attack.
So they weren't considered targets.
And if you go to those towns, even today, you can still see the damage.
That's an absolute lie, Gary.
Oh, yeah, perhaps it's just what they look like.
Those poor good citizens of Yarmouth and wherever it is, King's Lynn. Now, so they weren't defended. Now, what do you think the great British population, how do they react to this couple of bombs?
Well, there was total uproar. And they demanded that... anti-aircraft measures were further strengthened, and the Royal Naval Air Service coastal stations, they were instructed to have aircraft constantly ready for immediate action should a Zeppelin be sighted.
Now, they also decided to extend the blackout and lighting restrictions to many of the towns across the south of England, south Midlands of England too, yeah. Does this stop the Germans? No, of course it doesn't. And a series of Zeppelin raids do follow against what we call a variety of targets. But when was the first attack on London then?
Well, that was by LZ even. I'm not American. LZ-38 under the command of Hauptmann Eric Linnartz. And he arrived unseen over Stoke Newington, which is just up the road, at 23:20 on the 31st of May. So that'll be 31st May 1915. And passing over East London, he dropped grenades and incendiaries onto the houses below. One of the streets hit was Cowper Road. And you're going to be Mrs. C. Smith, again, a civilian. We don't know too many details. And you're going to tell her story.
I just got into bed when I heard a terrible rushing of wind and shouts of, "Fire! And the Germans are here!" I jumped out of bed and carried my four children into the basement and then went out to the street door and saw the house next door was on fire and people were helping get the children out. The father was burnt and the daughter, who my daughter used to play with, had met her death. We later found the poor little dear had crawled under the bed to get away from the flames. That's horrible. And that little girl was called Elsie Leggett and she was just 3 years old. And how do the British public react to this? There's a morbid curiosity, a fascination, isn't there?
Yeah, and unfortunately...
Well, a sister, May Leggett, died just shortly afterwards as well from her injuries. And how do the public react?
Well, thousands of people are reported to have paid a penny each to walk through the remnants of their former home.
Mm. Now, this raid creates a lot of panic, doesn't it? Anxiety, panic, the rest of it. But was there much damage actually caused by that raid by the LZ-38?
No, I mean, only £3,000 of bombs have been dropped and only 7 people killed, although 35 were injured. But this proved of little comfort to the bewildered population.
Now, what was the RNAS doing? They've got their anti-Zeppelin pilots, and you're gonna give an idea of why they weren't too effective. You're going to be left one of our old favourites. We did a podcast,
about him.
Lieutenant Graham Donald, RNAS.
The Zeppelin's alarm usually came during the night. It was rather absurd, but to please everybody, you had to put on a show of going out to chase Zeppelins. You had about as much chance of spotting a black cat in the Albert Hall in the dark.
Now, the raids continue over the following weeks, and they vary in effect, depending on what they find, how random bombs could fall. Sometimes they considerable loss of life. For instance, which raid would you pick on? I'm just avoiding saying a couple of German things there.
Well, Captain Lieutenant Heinrich Mathis' raid in L9 on Hull on the 6th of June, so that's a month after London, when high explosive bombs and incendiaries rained down and killed 24 people, wounded 40, and destroyed a lot of property.
This triggers something that's an unfortunate feature, but it's in a way it's understandable, but it's also reprehensible, because what do the great British public do?
Yeah, I mean, the local people, they're incensed and they start to attack anyone within their community who could possibly be regarded as of German origin.
So this is your pork butchers, this kind of thing. There were a lot of Germans around at that time in England.
Now, in London, there was a very real sense of disbelief that the heart of the British Empire could actually be under attack. And you're going to be Jane Ingleby.
I turned out of bed and looking up, I saw just above us two Zeps. The searchlights were on them and they looked as if they were among the stars. They were up very high and like cigar-shaped constellations. They kept getting away from the searchlights, only to be found out and caught again. It was lovely. And I ran upstairs to the attic from where I had a lovely view when the guns began and the whole place was full of smoke. But not much where I was. It made an infernal row. And all the time, I felt as if I was in a dream. Can this be London? Mm. Well, I mean, it is. I mean, the capital had never been attacked in this manner before, had it? So, now, there was some revenge, wasn't there? And that one young pilot, he was part of the Royal Naval Air Service Forward Defences. And they were based overseas. They were based in France and Belgium. And he cited, this is Lieutenant Reginald Warnford of 1 Squadron RNAS, and he cites, and you're going to be him, he cites the LZ-37 over Ostend at 0105, very early on the morning of the 7th of June 1915. What happens?
I arrived at Clear's quarters, a few miles past Bruges, at 1:50 a.m, and the airship opened heavy Maxim fire, so I retreated to gain height, and the airship turned and followed me. At 2:15 a.m, he seemed to stop firing, and at 2:25 a.m, I came behind, but well above the Zeppelin. Height, then, 11,000 feet, and switched off my engine to descend on top of him. When close above him, at 7,000 feet altitude, I dropped my bombs, and while releasing the last, there was an explosion which lifted my machine and turned it over. The aircraft was out of control for a short period, but went into a nosedive and the control was regained.
Now, that's quite incredible, thinking about that.
Dropping a bomb,
on a Zeppelin.
Now, the doomed Zeppelin, we have an account from that Zeppelin from a very lucky man. We'll come to why he's lucky later. But basically, the Zeppelin is falling down. It's on fire. It's a mess of flames and everything. I'm going to be Coxswain Alfred Müller.
Well, actually, can I just take you back? Because the Zeppelin crashes on a bunch of nuns, doesn't it?
It does. It does. That's the bit I was keeping to the end, yes, as I mentioned.
Yeah. But I just wondered.
Are you paying me back for all the spoilers?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if that's the right collective noun for nuns.
A bunch.
Yeah.
I think that's right. Well, what would you call them?
Well, not a habit of nuns. No. Anyway, you're going to be lucky coxswain Alfred Müller of LZ-37.
The men in the forward control car were the first to feel a great shudder of the impact and explosion. Above us, the vast envelope quivered and began to wrinkle and collapse. The wheel went dead in my hands and the gondola trembled. All around were shouts and confused orders. We were encompassed by an increasing and terrible heat. I saw dark shapes of men silhouetted against a ruddy glow as their flailing hands tried to protect their faces. Some of them climbed over the sides of the car and flung themselves into space. I could not make myself let go of the wheel. I clung to it like a drowning man until it broke in my hands. I was flung to the floor. The scorching heat increased and increased, and our clothes burst into flames. The gondola began to tilt and rock until, with a terrible sound, the breaking wood and metal, it tore away from the main structure and plunged towards the ground. I knew no more until I woke up in hospital. Now, what had happened to him was amazing. He crashes onto St. Elizabeth Convent. He goes right through the roof. And where does he land, Gary? Where? Where does he land?
Well, he lands in an empty bed.
Oh, so he says.
Yeah. Now, he's really fortunate, hence your comment about him being lucky, to escape with burns, bruising and shock.
In fact, he was more lucky than Warnford, because what happens to Warnford?
Well, Warnford, he was immediately awarded the VC... but he was killed just a few days later in a flying accident.
Yeah, it's quite sad. Now, on 7th of September, SL-2, under the command of Hauptmann Richard von Wabesser, flew first over... You didn't correct me.
Well, no, it was you said it like a native, really.
Whereof? Spain. Flew first over the East End before crossing the Thames to drop bombs on South London. Well... no, this isn't funny what happens here. The result in eight was 18 killed and 38 injured. And you're going to be Mrs. F.W. Smith. Now, she was then, although that's all we know, Mrs. F.W., it's presumably from a newspaper report. I can't remember where I got it from. She was then only a school child, age 8. So you've got to remember, this is a little girl's voice speaking. We're not doing impressions, though, because it's not funny.
I slept with my sister Dolly, age 6, in a front room of a top floor flat at number 181 Lyddeton Road, Rotherhithe. My mother and father slept in an adjoining room, and along a short passage was another bedroom where my other three sisters, Minnie, Kitty and Elsie, slept in one big bed. On this particular evening, Minnie had been out until 10 o'clock with my parents, as she had just won a scholarship and wanted a new outfit for her school next day. Being so late home, she kept right on the edge of the bed to avoid disturbing her sister's sleep. During the night, I was awakened by a terrible crash. I pulled Dolly out of bed and pushed her into the arms of my mother and father, who had just opened their door in alarm. As they left their bed, a wall collapsed across it. I went dashing across the corridor to call the other girls, followed by my mother. She pulled up in horror when I vanished. Where there had been a bedroom, there was nothing, and I fell through three floors into the ruins of the house. My mother and father and Dolly were carried down from the front window on a fire escape ladder. The other three girls were buried for hours. When they were finally reached, Elsie, the baby, and Minnie, who was 11, were just alive. Kitty, who was 9, was dead. Minnie owes her life to her late night because, being on the edge of the bed, she missed the crushing weight of concrete which killed her sisters. Poor little Elsie, who was always with Kitty in life, joined her in death.
Now, this is where I find this quite a sad piece. And it's worth remembering that although the casualties weren't great in number, They had a terrible impact.
Well, they impacted that family.
Oh, God, can you imagine being those parents or that little girl all her life? When, you know, when she's an adult woman, she still thinks back to it. I doubt if it ever left her mind. Now, another raid, 8th of September, the L-13. Who's that commanded by?
That's commanded by Captain Lieutenant Heinrich Matthey, and it causes severe damage as the bombs tumble down across London from Euston Station to Liverpool Street Station. One bomb, it scores a direct hit on a bus, and you're going to tell the story as Florence Williams.
I boarded the number 8 bus at Old Ford. When we reached the top of Bethnal Green Road, I heard a loud bang and screams. Looking up at the sky, I saw the searchlights all meet on a Zeppelin. As the bus went round Norton Folgate, I was very frightened and started to cry. A woman on a seat opposite came and sat by me and cuddled me up to her. Something seemed to tell me to get off the bus, and I broke away, though she made a grab at me to pull me back. There was an explosion, a blinding flash like lightning. The poor woman fell back with a terrible scream.
Wow. Now, the passengers were helpless as the blast shredded the bus with a combination of shrapnel and glass. In all, 9 passengers and the bus driver were killed, while another 10 were injured. And Florence Williams goes on to say,
I felt myself going down and my fall was broken by a man on the bottom step. We got entwined and fell into the roadway. He lay in the road with my hat in his hand and was later picked up dead. A woman inside the bus screamed, my baby, my baby. I heard afterwards she and her husband and baby were killed. I just got a glimpse of the conductor still standing at his post on the platform. He, poor man, had an eye destroyed, but remained there on duty. It turned out I had been peppered with shrapnel. She means little flens of, well, just bits of shrapnel, just not big chunks, but just cuts. Now, this raid, a lot of the people that were killed in that raid were killed on that bus. There were 22 deaths, of which 9 were on that bus. 87 injured and a lot of damage to buildings. How well did the London defences do? The aeroplanes, the anti-aircraft guns?
Well, the London defences, they opened up. The Zeppelin merely climbed higher to avoid the fire and it escaped unscathed. But behind it, it left a stunned
city.
Well,
it's happening time and time again. And the next quote has some fun, humorous elements. I can't help but think of my own dear family and your own dear family with this one. This is a Mr. W.A. Phillips, who is somewhat of a sexist pig. And he's going to just tell the story as he saw it.
The noise of the guns and shells bursting and the bombs bursting was terrific and most awesome. It was a great sight, but I hope to be spared seeing it again. Women simply went off their heads and were difficult to control. I locked my lot, wife and all, in the kitchen, but in less than a minute they were out through the window.
Just for some reason I've always found that funny. It's not funny, but it seemed funny. Talking of...
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Windows, it would have been lovely to open a window just at the moment, as Fred has finally...
Fred has farted, yes.
Yes, Fred. Thank you, Fred, for your contribution.
That's his contribution to Christmas as well. That's his gift to you.
Oh, it's lovely.
Now, some Londoners, embittered perhaps by a sense of helplessness, they work themselves into a frenzy of bile and hatred for the Germans.
And for some reason, you've given this quote to me to read, haven't you? Who
I have.
Am I going to be?
You're going to be Mr. J.H. Stapley.
To see the blasted bombs being dropped on helpless civilians and peaceable houses made the blood go to fever heat, and I felt absolutely mad. Anyway, they did some damage to poor little children and some harmless civilians going home from their daily toll, and the Germ Hun devils called it war. They don't know what war means. And, Mac, and they show it... I'm sorry, it's very difficult. And they show it immediately when they get up against a British bayonet, behind which are the boys of the bulldog breed, like yourself, for they are immediately begin to cry and whine like whipped curs. Doesn't sound like the Germans that we've heard about on the Western Front.
No, such feelings, they're widespread, and it led to an outcry in the press at the naked vulnerability of the capital.
So what do? They call for a pre-warned naval gunnery expert. Now, this chap was getting a bit old, but he'd been a real expert. He'd modernised naval gunnery. His name was Admiral Sir Percy Scott, and he was appointed to take command of London defences. Now, like any good planning officer, what did he do? He drew up a plan. What was it?
Well, he promptly draws up proposals for 104 anti-aircraft guns and over 50 accompanying searchlights. A mobile 75mm French anti-aircraft gun formed the basis of a special London mobile anti-aircraft section under the command of Lieutenant Commander Alfred Rawlinson.
Now, this we'll be coming back to this, because this mobile thing, armed with the mobile 75s, becomes quite a big thing. They were stuck on the back of lorries, as I remember, and they would whiz about. But it's quite a big thing. Now, the last great raid of 1915, when was that?
Well, that took place on the 13th of October, when 5 Zeppelins roamed over southern England, often confused about their exact location, but dropping bombs on seemingly worthwhile targets.
Now, one of them, the L5, dropped a load of bombs across London's Theatreland. And this, again, it caused 28 deaths, 70 wounded. And you're going to be one of my ancestors, Sidney Hart. Who was an actor, and
I was playing in the Prodigal Son at the Aldwych Theatre. Milton Ross was speaking his lines when we heard a terrible boom. A bomb had found its mark in the middle of the road opposite the Lyceum Theatre, and the burst gas main became ignited. I was standing at the side of the stage and was scared stiff, frozen still. I took one look at the audience and saw that there was panic. In terror, I hid behind a piece of scenery, but only for a second. Then I rushed onto the deserted stage and shouted to the pianist, "Play Temporary!" He did, and I started to sing it to the fighting, scrambling mass that was the audience. My action had the desired effect, and some people began to applaud. Then Milton Rossell returned and took up his lines with me, although I was not concerned with the lines he was speaking. We carried on until the other actors returned and the show proceeded.
Now, that winter meant it's just too, the weather was too bad for Zeppelin raids, and so they pack up for a bit. During that winter, there's a lot of effort to try and improve London's defences, its anti-aircraft defences. And this is where we turn back to Rawlinson's, a different Rawlinson. Alfred Rawlinson, Lieutenant Commander Alfred Rawlinson. He's got this complete mobile brigades thing. Now, I was there the other day because they have a variety of mobile guns, searchlights, all on lorries and trailers.
I'm slightly worried then when you said I was there.
No. I was there where they were based, because they were based at Kenwood House. And you know where Kenwood House is.
Hampstead Heath.
At the top of Hampstead Heath.
Yeah.
And I was there with Big Rog, as we like to call him, and a couple of other chums. I mean, Kenwood House is still there. And
so let me just establish this. You went over Hampstead Heath with Big Rog and a couple of other chums.
Yes.
Okay.
Hampstead Heath's famous as a place for walking and enjoying.
With chums.
Right. Now, so the idea is, from up there, if you think about it, they can be dispatched to anywhere they were needed if there was a raid. There were also, though, fixed batteries. More fixed batteries were being established around at key points around the capital. They were also... what is one of the disadvantages of firing anti-aircraft shell? What goes up...
comes down. So there was design work initiated into the development of high-explosive shells to ensure that they fragmented in such a way that lethal large pieces were not left to fall on the hapless inhabitants of London.
I was just switching my phone off. Sorry, it was going annoying.
That could do as much damage as the Zeppelins.
Well,
to be honest.
I mean, if a big chunk of anti-aircraft shell fell on your nut, that's going to kill you just as much as a bomb. That bit would, yeah. Now, so how do they start 1916? Do the Germans decide peace and love to all?
No, in the first raid of 1916, the Germans attempt their most ambitious raid yet. On the night of 31st of January, a fleet of 9 airships set out in the direction of Liverpool.
Liverpool?
Liverpool.
Home of the finest football club that the world has ever seen.
And docks, then.
And docks, yeah. You, of course, you're right. And now, what is the biggest problem in trying to get to Liverpool if you don't really know where it is and it's dark?
Well, the navigational confusion overwhelmed the airship commanders.
They get lost, don't they?
Yeah, none of them reach their targets. Instead, they drop their bombs across the Midlands, which hitherto had considered itself safe from attack and had not introduced either blackout precautions or gun batteries.
Yeah, all right. I mean, and this is, in a sense, Britain's industrial heartland, and they had just, all told, one Royal Flying Corps aircraft based near Birmingham. And casualties, they were heavy. And I noticed that the numbers are going up. What is the casualties this time?
This time there's 70 people dead and 113 injured. The raid showed what could have been achieved if the Zeppelins had avoided the magnet of London, which was the only area in the country to be really well defended.
So if they'd not concentrated on the place where most of the defences were, they might have achieved more.
Now, as a result of that raid, the area of blackout was extended and arrangements tightened up for the prompt dissemination of air raid warnings across the country.
How is the great British public? And they are the great British public. How are they reacting, and how are the press reacting? There's one paper in particular that I've got in mind, and one paper that you read. How do they react?
Well, during the opening months of 1916, the calls for reprisals, they grow steadily. In spring, the Daily Mail began one of its inimitably xenophobic campaigns under the banner "Hit Back, Don't Wait and See." And this would become a constant theme for the rest of the war.
What do they mean? By hit back.
Well, presumably they want us to go and bomb Germany in some shape or form.
Yeah, that's what they want. And they think that'll stop them. In other words, do you think it would stop them, or would it just make it worse?
No, it'd just escalate, wouldn't it?
Now, but meanwhile, there's been a bit of a change between... the War Office, has it accepted the Royal Naval Air Service's, the Navy's dominant role in home defence?
No, and as the RFC grows in numbers and strength, they begin negotiations to regain their former position as the sole defender of the homeland.
Yes, well, do the negotiations go well, or are they protracted?
No, protracted negotiations, but after a lengthy period of time, a decision's finally made, and that does vastly simplify the situation. Henceforth, the Navy and the Royal Naval Air Service were to deal with all aircraft attempting to reach Britain.
So they're sort of on the front foot. So this is, one's going across the soggy bits?
The channel, yes. And the Army and the Royal Flying Corps would deal with all those that actually succeeded in getting through.
Not a bad arrangement, I would have thought. Now, the army, therefore, is back in charge of home defence, and it doesn't really change the direction of anti-Zeppelin defences, although they are more keen on the potential of aircraft in shooting them down. Probably because, to be honest, they've just had more experience with aircraft. After all, they've been fighting the Germans on the Western Front for 2 years by then. But they do plan it in some ways better. A really comprehensive plan. Can you give me some idea of some of the points of that?
Well, as you say, it was fairly comprehensive. It included the whole country, including all the major industrial centres, and more anti-aircraft guns were needed as a result. And although previous manufacturing orders were nearing completion, the pressure to build and find resources was such that 90 18-pounder guns were specially adapted for anti-aircraft fire to fill the gaps.
So they're given high-angle capability. Well, that's interesting, because 90 guns, couldn't they have done that with them on the Western Front?
Well, certainly could have done, couldn't they? Now, the increasingly efficient mobile anti-aircraft brigade...
That's Rawlinson's thing at Kenwood House.
That was transferred lock, stock and barrel to the army for the duration of hostilities.
Now, what about an early warning system? What are they doing at this point?
Well, it's overhauled because there were a number of false alarms and they wanted to eliminate them.
Why? What's the problem with false alarms? Isn't it better that everybody's better to be warned if nothing's happening, surely, than what? Or is there another problem?
Yeah, but think about some of the indirect effects of that. So such scares severely impeded war production, for example, as huge areas were blacked out and the factories closed down the length and breadth of the country.
Now, this is serious, because I was playing devil's advocate there. Of course it's serious, because if you have something like a steel furnace... If you close down a Bessemer plant, it takes a long time to get it going again.
And that can actually achieve more than for the German war effort than any bomb could directly. And that had to be avoided as far as possible.
So if production stops across
well,
half
exactly
the Midlands...
what the Germans want.
Yeah, of course it does. So what do they do to try and avoid false alarms?
Well, as a result, a system of observers was set up, not only on the coast, but right across Britain.
And they're connected, aren't they, by telephone to... controllers, warning controllers, and then they're a system of disseminating it to all the sub-districts if they thought that the Zeppelin was actually going to be over their area. So they're tracking them. This is the sort of thing that becomes famous in the Second World War, isn't it, which hadn't happened.
Yes. Now, since the start of 1915, the Royal Flying Corps, they'd deployed specially trained night flying pilots on readiness for anti-Zeppelin duties while they're waiting to go overseas. Yet in reality, training in night flying was still in its infancy. And Arthur Harris, the Arthur Harris, I presume.
It is, Bomber Harris. Which is why him defending against air raids, it's quite amusing, but yeah.
He received scant instruction before being nominated as the anti-Zeppelin pilot at Northolt. And you're going to be Lieutenant Arthur Harris, Royal Flying Corps.
When I reported to the adjutant, he said, "Can you fly in the dark?" I said, "Well, I can't fly in the daylight. Maybe it's easier in the dark." He said, "Well, you're the anti-Zeppelin pilot here." So I said, "What does that mean?" He told me, "Well, the station supplies a pilot for every odd night, and you are the permanent Zeppelin every other odd night. There are two machines up in the end hangar which you have to look after. They are your machines. Go to it!" That very night, in thick, drizzly weather, the station commander, who was the duty pilot that night, went up and killed himself before he'd gone 100 yards beyond the end flare. That was my introduction. The next night, it was my turn. I was told to see if I could find an army airship which was going to fly around pretending it was a Zeppelin.
Oh, dear.
Well, by the most astonishing bit of good fortune, both the airship and myself, I found it by very nearly running into it. It had put its lights on in a panic when it saw me coming, and I suppose that was regarded as a bit of skillful scouting navigation on my part. Whereas, as a matter of fact, all I'd done is fly blindly into the night and hope for the best. So, random. But there's no radar, no lights. It's like Donald said, it's like looking for a black cat in a big Albert Hall in the dark.
Now, despite the pressing demands of the Western Front, it was decided that special home defence squadrons were absolutely essential. And as a result of a new home defence wing was formed, with squadrons disposed at key locations across the country, and with 39 squadron responsible for the defence of London.
But one thing's changed as we move into 1916. It makes a real difference between the battle between, sort of, you can portray it as a David and Goliath, a little flimsy, tiny aeroplane and a great big, huge sausage. What is that thing that changes the balance of power between them?
Well, it's the invention of effective incendiary and explosive bullets. Previously, a drum or two of Lewis gun bullets, 47.
I was going to say 41.
It had just passed through the Zeppelin hydrogen gas bags and caused leaks, which might busy those members of the crew responsible for patching it up, but it wouldn't actually cause enough gas to be lost to do more than sort of inconvenience the Zeppelin.
Yeah, but what's changed now then?
Well, once the Lewis gun drums are filled with a combination of Buckingham, Brock and Pomeroy bullets, the Zeppelin became incredibly vulnerable.
Because they'd set fire to the hydrogen gas, wouldn't they?
Yeah. So as the Zeppelin raids continued in the spring and summer of 1916, it was clear that the improved anti-aircraft batteries were having a deterrent effect, forcing the Zeppelins ever higher and scoring damaging hits.
So it's not only that they've got this new ammunition, it's also that there's more and better.
The system on the ground is actually beginning to tell.
Now, if you go higher, the bombing's less accurate. That's interesting as well. Now, the Zeppelins, they'd been intercepted by aircraft before, but the Zeppelin has always managed to escape, hadn't they? But their luck changes when a raid by 16, Gary, Zeppelins on the night of 2nd, 3rd of September 1916. And that is the day that the balance of power passes to the aircraft. And you're going to be Muriel Darrell Browning.
At 2:30, I was awakened by a terrific explosion and was at the window in one bound when another deafening one shook the house. Nearly above us sailed a cigar of bright silver in the full glare of about 20 magnificent searchlights. A few lights roamed around trying to pick up his companions. Our guns made a deafening roar and shells burst all around her. For some extraordinary reason, she was dropping no bombs. The sight was absolutely still, with a few splendid stars. It was a magnificent sight, and the whole of London was looking on, holding its breath.
It's like a giant theatre, the skies of London, as this drama. And now it's got searchlights, just like in a theatre, and it means people can see.
Now, into this natural theatre flies Lieutenant William Leif Robinson on anti-Zeppelin patrol. He'd taken off at 23:08 in his B-2C...
We've heard of them.
We have. From 39 Squadron's headquarters at Sutton's Farm Airfield, and he climbed slowly to his patrol height. And you're going to be Lieutenant William Leif Robinson of 39 Squadron Royal Flying Corps.
At about 2:05 a.m, a Zeppelin was picked up by the searchlights over north-northeast London, as far as I could judge. I flew about 800 feet below it from bow to stem and distributed one drum along it, alternatively New Brock and Pomeroy. It seemed to have no effect. I therefore moved to one side and gave it another drum distributed along its side without apparent effect. I then got behind it. By this time I was very close, 500 feet or less below, and concentrated one drum on one part underneath rear. I was then at a height of 11,500 feet. I'd hardly finished the drum before I saw the part fired at glow. In a few seconds, the whole rear part was blazing. When the third drum was fired, there was no searchlights on the Zeppelin and no anti-aircraft was firing. I quickly got out of the way of the falling, blazing Zeppelin and, being very excited, fired off a few red Very lights and dropped a parachute flare. Now, this isn't a Zeppelin. It's actually a chute lance, which is it's the SL-11. It's different. It's got a wooden frame instead of a metal frame. And it also contains highly inflammable hydrogen, a bit like, that's methane, he's asked.
Now, once at night, the blaze quickly became a conflagration.
A what, Gary?
A conflagration.
He was on fire.
Yes, which could be seen both at close quarters by Leif Robinson and in the distance by the team in thousands standing in the streets of London.
Thousands.
And Lieutenant William Leif Robinson goes on to say,
when the colossal thing actually burst into flames, of course it was a glorious sight. Wonderful. It literally lit up all the sky, all around, and me as well, of course. I saw my machine as in the firelight and sat still, half dazed, staring at the wonderful sight before me, not realising to the least degree the wonderful thing that had happened. My feelings? Can I describe my feelings? I hardly know how I felt as I watched the huge mass gradually turn on end and, as it seemed to me, slowly sink. One glowing, blazing mass, I gradually realised what I had done and grew wild with excitement. Now, he's awarded the VC, the Victoria Cross, for this, isn't he?
Yeah, he's the first to be given a VC for an action fought with an enemy over or on British soil.
Now, what's it look like from the ground? Well, it's quite a sight, the demise of the SL-11, and you're once again going to be Muriel Dayrell Browning.
From the direction of Barnet and very high, a brilliant red light appeared. We thought it was an English fire balloon for a minute. Then we saw it was the Zepp diving head first. That was a sight. She dived slowly at first, as only the foremost ballonet was on fire. Then the second burst, and the flames tore up into the sky. And then the third, and cheers thundered all around us from every direction. The glare lit up all of London and was rose red. Those deaths must have been the most dramatic in the world's history. They fell, a cone of blazing wreckage, thousands of feet, watched by 8 million of their enemies. It was magnificent, the most thrilling scene imaginable.
Wow. Well, people do refer to it a lot. Now, it eventually falls to earth near Cuffley in Hertfordshire, and it's right in front of the house of a young schoolboy, 15-year-old schoolboy, Gary. What was his name? Who am I going to be?
You're going to be Patrick Blunstone, who was staying in Cuffley on holiday.
There, right above us, was the Zepp. It had broken in half and was in flames, roaring and crackling. It went slightly to the right and crashed down into a field. It was about 100 yards away from the house and directly opposite us. It nearly burnt itself out when it was finished by the Cheshire Fire Brigade. I'd rather not describe the condition of the crew. Of course they were dead, burnt to death. They were roasted. There's absolutely no other word for it. They were brown, like the outside of roast beef. One had his legs off at the knees, and you could see the joint.
Just to correct it, Cheshunt.
I've never known how he... Funnily enough, I was talking about a chum of mine, Stuart Pentecost, saying he lived at that place. And
Cheshunt. Dogs contributed again.
Yeah,
now,
dog.
As if this first success over London had broken the spell, over the following months there were a string of successes as several more airships were brought down. On the 1st of October, Captain Lieutenant Heinrich Matti, commanding L-31, was shot down over Potter's Bar.
Now, you're going to be the person who did it. This is 2nd Lieutenant Woolston. What a name. I wish I was called Woolston. Woolston Tempest.
What a great name that is.
Again, the squadron responsible for London, 39 Squadron, RFC.
The Zeppelin was now nearly 15,000 feet high and mounting rapidly. I therefore decided to dive at her. For although I held a slight advantage in speed, she was climbing like a rocket and leaving me standing. I'll say that again. Like a rocket and leaving me standing. I accordingly gave a tremendous pump at my petrol tank and dived straight at her, firing a burst straight into her as I came. I let her have another burst as I passed under her, and then banking my machine over, sat under her tail, and flying along underneath her, pumped lead into her for all I was worth.
Can I just say, I could see what he might have done wrong here in other circumstances, flying underneath her.
Mm. I could see tracer bullets flying from her in all directions, but I was too close under her for her to concentrate on me. As I was firing, I noticed her begin to go red inside like an enormous Chinese lantern, and then a flame shot out of the front part of her, and I realised she was on fire. She then shot up 200 feet, paused and came roaring down straight onto me before I had time to get out of the way. I nosedived for all I was worth, with the Zepp tearing after me, and expected every minute to be engulfed in the flames. I put my machine into a spin and just managed to corkscrew out of the way as she shot past me, roaring like a furnace. I righted my machine
and watched her hit the ground with a shower of sparks. I then proceeded to fire off dozens of green very lights in the exuberance of my feelings.
I love that. That is a wonderful... Can you imagine? I've shot it down. Ha 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 ha. As it comes, I mean, it must have been an amazing sight as it comes tearing after him.
But also, he's now the second person, isn't he, to let off the very lights as some sort of celebration of the act of shooting one of these things down.
Yeah, well, they're just so amazing, yeah. Now, this is part of a string. There's a string of British successes, anti-aircraft guns, pilots, shooting down Zeppelins in late autumn 16. What does it show? What does it show, Gary?
Well, it demonstrates that when an aeroplane armed with a new incendiary and explosive ammunition got an airship in its sights, then it was inevitably doomed.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be one of the most modern aircraft, did it? Because what did we say the aircraft was Leif Robinson was flying?
It was a BE-2C, and that's a much castigated machine. I think that's the one that was designed to have a steady platform, wasn't
it? Yeah, it was the one that was, it was just completely out. It was a 1914 aeroplane, reconnaissance aircraft.
Now, that was the BE-2C was responsible for destroying 9 of 21 airships downed by aeroplanes.
Wow, wow. There's a pre-war fear that German airships would be able to range with impunity over in their Zeppelins over Britain. Now that had almost appeared to be true in 1915, but what's happened to it in late 1916?
Well, that's been exploding, and although airships continue to raid right the way through until August 1918. By the end of the second year, even the Germans could see that the hour of the airship had passed.
Gone.
Now, this is the first in a series, Pete, isn't it?
First of two, yeah.
that's a series.
It is. It's a serious
matter. If there was three, it'd be lots.
Yeah, one, two, three, lots. Yeah. We're looking to the second one. The second one's more on the Gothas. It's 1718. And the Zeppelins make a brief return in 18. I think it's interesting. A change of pace for us too as well, isn't it, Gary?
It is. Now, we hope you've enjoyed the podcast today. If you have, perhaps you'd like to visit Buy Me a Coffee, and indeed, Buy Me a Coffee. Don't buy Pete one.
No.
Pete just doesn't want one. But I would like one. And in fact, I'll have Pete's as well.
That's very noble of you, Gary. It's been lovely recording the podcast with you.
Yeah, now, we're probably approaching New Year when this is broadcast, so...
Oh, I don't know.
We hope that all our listeners have a great New Year. It's certainly better than 2021, and we hope you continue to listen to the podcast.
We do. Cheers, Gary.
Cheers, Pete. Happy New Year.
Happy Sausage Year.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?